Hey, movie fans, welcome back for another Anatomy of Movie here on Popcorn Talk. Your mission, should you choose to watch or listen, is to listen to us talk about Mission Impossible 6, quite possibly the best in the franchise. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Anatomy of a Movie.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. If you've gotten this far, it's too late to turn back. Now you have to watch the whole show. We have Marissa Serafini.
Hello, everyone.
We have Dimitri Panos.
Hey, movie fans, the fuse has been lit.
That's right. Hopefully it doesn't fizzle out. And in fact, creates a great thing. I'm Phil Svitek. As mentioned, we're talking Tom Cruise, Christopher McQuarrie, Mission Impossible, : Fallout, MI6. As we always do, we are not just a review show. We're an in-depth show that talks about the makings of all of this. We talk about the box office, the promotion, especially with a movie like this. The story's okay, but the interesting aspects is how they made this. And of course, we talk box office numbers and also the reception of it. As I mentioned at the top, quite possibly the best movie. We'll find out who's saying that and who's not saying that. If we're saying that, too. You can follow along with our rundown. It's in the description box. It's a little PDF. You just click that, and it's got tons of great notes for you. And lastly, if you couldn't tell, if you're joining us for the very first time, well, hey, welcome. But spoiler warning, not just perhaps for this movie, but for all the MI movies. Mm-hmm. So be forewarned there. If you haven't seen it, please do yourself a favor. I know some of you guys like to listen to this regardless of having seen the movie. I highly, highly discourage that. Not discouraging you from ever listening to the show, but just see this movie first before listening to us. Anyway, without further ado, let us get into overall thoughts. Marissa Serafini.
Yeah, I was really excited.
Give us your dossier.
Yeah, I was really excited for this film. I really usually enjoy the Mission Impossible films, and like they're really high action. I think the storylines are great. I think Rogue Nation was fantastic, and I saw that so many times that when I saw the trailer for this one, I got even more amped and more excited for this one compared to Rogue Nation, and I think this was just as great. I love the cast. I love the storylines. I was really excited to see this, and it exceeded all my expectations because we know it's high octane. It just hit on so many levels for me. I really enjoyed it. I can't wait to talk about it.
Awesome. Dimitri.
Yeah, I mean, this is a series that has gotten better and has revamped itself. You know, you had Brian De Palma doing the first one. John Woo directed Mission Impossible 2. And then we get J.J. Abrams, who sort of kind of takes it into in each one. So you had the Brian De Palma. John Woo's a different director than Brian De Palma. J.J. Abrams is different than the both of them, right? And he brings it in, you know, he actually introduces story elements that are relevant throughout the rest of the series up till now, right? Up until Fallout. Then you get Brad Bird, right? A fantastic director. And then this Chris McQuarrie, you know, this guy, he sort of knows his stuff, right? And he's the only director to come back to do a sequel, so to speak,
and
within this franchise. And literally, I think it's the best action movie of the summer. It stands out from every action movie that you can see within the year or so because of the stunts and because it's you really get the sense that this is Tom Cruise is doing this. And if I were to ever interview him, one of my first questions would be, what is missing in your life that you need to be hanging from a helicopter? Like, but it lends a realism to this movie. Like, we talked a few weeks ago about Rampage. Not Rampage. We talked about Skyscraper. Mm-hmm. Fun movie and all. But you know that The Rock ain't hanging from a girder, like, you know, 100,000 feet up in the air, where Tom Cruise is. Yeah. And it lends this realism, that this edge-of-your-seat adrenaline rush that you don't get today. And this movie delivers. Right now, I'd have to say it's probably my top two films of the year. I remember seeing, and we'll talk, I know more about this, but at CinemaCon, Chris McQuarrie, Tom Cruise came out, and they did a film 101 about the Halo jump.
Yes, you gotta give him a tease. You're giving all the way the goods.
I'm not, because here's the thing. They had me hooked on that, right? And that comes in the first 20 minutes of the movie. And everything after it is equally as amazing as... I was like, you would think the Halo jump would be a benchmark. It's not. There's more of this movie, and it was just amazing. I thought the twists were fun. One of them I felt was a MacGuffin, but I just felt from a story perspective, it was so solid and so fun.
Absolutely.
It was great, yeah.
Well, I'll summarize it in this way. I can't take credit for this quote. I forget who said it, but one man's vanity has never been more beneficial for a movie. Because part of it, yeah. In that way, every shot that's there is meant to showcase that this is Tom Cruise actually doing the action. And the movie's better for it, because you see that, oh, it's Tom Cruise doing the action. And secondly, what I appreciate most about this movie is that even though it's a little bit long, it takes its time very deliberately. Each action set piece, it's not... Believe it, as fast-paced and high-octane as it is, it takes its time. Everything is very methodical, and it just goes on. Each little sequence, most movies would cut right away and things like that. This just keeps going and going and really intensifies the action that you're seeing. So yeah. Each action set piece in and of itself could be a short movie.
Oh, mm-hmm. For sure. And I think that's what makes Mission Impossible series like so iconic and so relevant just in filmmaking style, because they have set a bar for action films. When you talk about what makes an action film, you like in the dictionary you would see Mission Impossible right next to it. And I think that's why everyone enjoys it, because they up the ante every single freaking movie and you're like, "What else can you do next?"
Yeah, and it's, and again, it just goes to what's missing in your life, Mr. Cruise? Why do you put yourself through this? And to your point, though, when we start talking about Tom Cruise and such, because we talked about him last year in The Mummy, and I think it's important to bring up in the conversation, because he works well with people who I believe are his muses, and vice versa. Director, actor, actor, director. And I don't necessarily call it vanity. He's just willing to put himself out there, and he has been since the beginning. And if you're a movie geek and nerd like myself, and you get the Blu-rays or DVDs or whatever it is, and you watch the bonus features, and you see him doing these, it has become part of their marketing. You know, it's become a marketing tool showing that, yes, we had Tom Cruise in Dubai hanging off the tallest building. We had him in Shanghai sliding down this, you know.
Skyscraper.
And it's become part of the marketing. And it works, because when you see it and you walk out of the theater when you're done, you hear people around you going, "The action was off the rails. The action was amazing." They're on their phones talking about the action. And it looks so unique, because there doesn't seem to be a lot of blue screen involved.
Yeah. And what's great, what I do appreciate, and we'll see if they can keep up the pace should they choose to continue, pun intended. We're getting these movies faster and faster. Certainly from the shortest amount of time between two movies in the Mission Impossible franchise is this. Mm-hmm. And not only that, this one happens to be the longest in the series. Uh-huh. And as we've mentioned at this point, they didn't phone it in. It's not like, oh, let's just crank out another one and call it a day. They took their time. And in fact, the movie wasn't completed until July 3rd, which is just a couple of days before the premiere.
Right. And like this, the production was pushed a few months because of Tom Cruise's ankle-breaking moment. And so, like, had that not happened, it might have been released earlier, even though they had a set date for this movie. But, I mean, we could have gotten it faster. But I don't mind that it got released only 3 years later, because it is, this particular one, Fallout, is so tied to Rogue Nation. And a lot of the Mission Impossibles are very, you can say, isolated, very self-contained. In the most part, you can watch whatever one by itself and enjoy it. This one does heavily tie to the last one.
It does, but it's, again, starting with the J.J. Abrams when he introduces Michelle Monaghan's character, who's been a threat throughout, which has been fascinating because it's the movies somewhat hinge on them and they don't. It's been a fascinating, great franchise to watch, and to see it mature. And to your point, Phil, Chris McQuarrie in writing this, I did feel that he wanted to ensure that the audience was able to follow along, and he did it in that sort of this exposition way that didn't feel like exposition. Took its time before it got to the next set piece, so. By the time we get there, we know why we're there, and we know what that mission, aka set piece, what need be accomplished. So he sets up the barriers, and that's really solid screenwriting. And again, this is the guy that, you know, Usual Suspects. This guy. Well, wrote, so
here's one of the things that just floored me, and because you have the Blu-rays and so forth, and you watch the commentary, maybe you've heard this part of it too. When they're talking, this is for the last movie, but they talk about it applying to this movie as well. They kind of just create these scenarios and leave blanks. So, for example, when they're like, "Hey, we got to go do this," and he's looking at a screen, they'll fill the screen in later with mumbo jumbo as far as what the actual thing is. And they'll film whoever saying, "Okay, got it, we'll do whatever that we'll do is," and then move on to. So they're and as far as the script, they're just kind of writing it as they go, and I was just floored by this because. The sheer magnitude that a movie like this exists, and yes, it's far-fetched as far as its MacGuffins and what's the stakes of it all, but the fact that it makes any sense whatsoever is a miracle and a testament to them being able to pull this off.
Yeah, and, you know, just taking what Marissa said a few moments ago about how this ties into the last movie, Rogue Nation... They also took great care to tie it into the very first Impossible, Mission Impossible movie as well. This is the daughter of Max, who right now I forget who the esteemed actress was
that played
Vanessa Redgrave. This is the daughter of Max, who was in the first movie, and there was some great banter, and this Max played a great part in the first movie. Some amazing banter between her and Cruise or Ethan Hunt. So it's really funny how they integrate that little Easter egg and they tie it back to the original. And it also shows this growth of Ethan Hunt's character as well coming into this. Because if you Cable has had the Mission Impossible movies on, and when you look at him in the first one, and you compare him to now, like how Ethan Hunt has... matured in a sense. It's quite a fascinating franchise to watch from beginning to up to now. And Chris McQuarrie, again, the way that they'll talk about, we need to do a Halo jump. Yeah, okay. All right, how are we going to fit that? How do we make it fit into... It's like they come up with the scenario. It's like, how do we fit that into a movie? Oh, well, then we got to do this, and then we get to there. You know?
And it makes... sense. I mean, out of all the things that they needed to pull off, the Halo jump was the least. Like, okay, you really didn't need to do that, but okay.
But he wanted to.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like they could have just walked in somehow.
It's like, is there an easier way to
but
make
why?
An entrance?
Like, there's no excitement in that. You know, the Halo jump, again, like I said, I saw it in its rawest form, and I was still on the edge of my seat and learning how they did it. It was great. Seeing it fully realized, I'm like, wow, this is great. But then there's the helicopter scene at the end.
Since we're on the Halo, might as well dive in there, and then we'll backtrack a bit to the story.
Dive in?
Yes, indeed. So high altitude, low opening is what Halo truly stands for. You can also do high altitude, wide opening, but we're not about that here. Yeah. Marissa, give us the intel on Halo.
Yeah, so they had to do over 106 jumps to get like all the moving parts and like piece it together. But and the interesting thing about the jump is also the cinematographer was he had the experience in filming, but not in a narrative standpoint. The cinematographer that they used was actually like very experienced in jumping, but not experienced in storytelling. So they had to rehearse so many times just with the cinematographer to make sure he captured the actor movements and certain aspects of that, just for the storytelling, let alone the actual technical aspect of it. But I mean, and it's cool because you really don't think of it for a Halo jump as like, oh, let's just jump out of a plane. No, not really. And they had to do a lot of it during the film. It was like sunset time.
Right.
So they only had a small window during the day that they could film it. It was like technically a night sequence, but it was in the window of like light just after sundown. And to get all these jumps within a 3-minute window over 100 plus times, I mean, good for them. And that was just the Halo sequence.
Yeah, well, and just to take it further, it was, outside of only having about 3 minutes or so to get the right sunlight for continuity purposes, you had, and again, McQuarrie and Cruise talked about this. They showed us drawings. They showed us animatics of it. And then they showed us a rough cut. They showed the audience a rough cut. And the cameraman, as you were talking about, not only was it like precision choreographed, so the cameraman himself had the rig up on his head, okay? So he could not see through the camera, and he had the controls of the camera in his hands. So he had to figure out, again, where people were, and to keep them in focus, he had to jump out of the plane first, backwards, so that Tom Cruise had to come within
three to four feet.
There really was very little give in order for him to be in focus, to be in the proper focus. So it relied on the cameraman. It relied on Tom Cruise. They made a special rig so that you can see their faces, because most Halo jumps, and we've seen Halo jumps before. Godzilla used a Halo jump.
Yeah.
And they have a mask that covers your face. And they're like, well, we can't cover the actors' faces because we want this real. So Tom Cruise, and again, in his professionalism, he jumps out of the plane and is able to literally float, hover above his cameraman for just and be within that level of 3 feet and inches, give or take. And he couldn't vary off, and then let the cameraman fly around him and let him go down. The brilliance of all this is that it looks like one, right there, it looks like one continual shot. And then go ahead, and they showed us each section through animatics and how it was filmed, and it was just 106 times. It's amazing. And when you throw in the special effects, like, which we never saw, and they were saying, okay, this is where the lightning strikes. Like, when you see it, and the lightning strikes, and it, that sound kicks in the soundtrack, and you're like, oh, I was still in the edge of my seat.
And granted, all the Halo jumps were done after Tom had injured his ankle, yeah. So this was already, like, far into production. And just the cinematography and the technical aspect, they had to custom design the gear for Tom Cruise just for this Halo jump, because they had to illuminate, you know, his face for the acting.
And the same with Henry.
And Henry Cavill. Just so us, the audience, can understand who's in, you know, who's who when they're jumping. So just to light it properly. And the gear, because it is a true Halo jump too, one spark could have lit Tom's head on fire, and obviously that would be bad. So a lot of things went into just the Halo jump.
Yeah, it was incredible. And when you think about it too, that's 106 days of shooting. Because it was, they couldn't do multiple jumps in a day because of the sunlight. That's almost a year's worth in putting about 3 minutes on film, give or take. That's 106 days of filming.
That's definitely a long time. And there's a good, it's not an exact quote, but paraphrasing, Henry Cavill said that nothing be a Superman prepared him to be in this action movie. And you would think Superman flies. Well, no, he does not.
No, he doesn't.
He falls no. out of a plane, and it's not the same.
No.
So
Craig O'Brien was the cinematographer for the Halo jump.
Craig O'Brien.
Craig O'Brien.
So, and it pays off well on screen. Like, again, it just it all just shows, and we've talked about this with other movies, but no other movie that we have talked about can really encompass and embody when you use practicality to film something. It just looks the way it does. Unlike, you know, we've talked Marvel movies and they're great and all that, but you know, none of it is
mostly
actually happening.
Blue screen. And also, I think the last film that we talked about were like real practical stunts, kind of to this level, but not as high, obviously. It was probably Tomb Raider, because we talked about how they had to drop Alicia Vikander into the water over 20 times.
Right.
Compared to 106 times for a Halo jump. I mean, that it does happen with real actors, but you think 20 is a lot? 106 is a lot.
Yeah, and again, it just goes back to And like, hopefully we get to talk about this a little later, but I think it's the simpatico that Chris McQuarrie and Tom Cruise have. Because if you go back to movies like Jack Reacher, which I think was their first film together, and you look at the car chase sequence, right? That's Tom Cruise actually driving that car. It's a real car. It's a legit car chase that is not blue screened at all. Tom Cruise doing his own driving, which in Rogue Nation, there's the great, great car chase scene that
happens.
Motorbike
scene, too.
Yeah, the motorcycle scene. It's something that he and McQuarrie can work out. Tom Cruise knows how to ride a motorcycle. He was doing it at least since Mission Impossible 2. And they just ramp it up more and more and more. The car chase scene here is again, Finn, you're just weaving in and out, especially to the motorcycle. It's crazy, and not even necessarily having to use a soundtrack. It's so ramped up, and you're on the edge of your seat. It's what summer movie going is about. And you can tell the realism.
Absolutely. And in fact, I was going to say, I would love Tomb Raider's Paramount, right? They should do like some cross collaboration of Ethan Hunt. And
dude, how awesome would that be? Tom Cruise and Alicia Vikander? Absolutely.
Absolutely. Anyway, there's my plug to Paramount. You want to make some money? Do that.
There you go.
All right. So let's talk about it. This is kind of the first big, well, not the first big thing, but this is where the fallout, the title of the movie, really starts to have a meaning, because Solomon Lane, they're out to get him, and you know it's never going to go easy. We have the dream sequence, or whatever you want to call it, the fantasy sequence of how it's supposed to go.
Right.
And just a little quick side note on that, Christopher McQuarrie, as far as he went to the editor, because the editor's like, we got to have some sound and something in this. And he's like, no, because that'll give away the notion that it's a fantasy. Or it'll engrave it in people's mind that it's real, and what we're going for, we need them to know that this is a fantasy, because then what happens is quite the opposite.
Right.
And so when you talk about the motorcycle chase scene, that's one aspect of this really elongated. I mean, I don't even know how to properly break this up into parts as far as each little section. And what's great is that you have multiple things going on at the same time happening. Yeah. You have Solomon Lane in the truck. You have the introduction of Ilsa. Again, you know, we saw her in the bathroom, but now she's back at it. And all that going into it.
I completely agree, because they did a great job of explaining to the audience, like, this is going to happen here. You're going to get diverted here. And then that's all the audience knew. It was like, we knew they were going to go off on a detour. That's it. And so when you add the factor of Ilsa following them, you don't expect that. When you add the fact that they changed it after they diverted, we were like, where is this going to go? Because we as the audience only knew that they were going to get diverted and knew nothing else afterwards. And I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah. So the great thing about this, too, is filming this scene. So Chris McQuarrie, you know, has said, he's not unaccustomed to filming a chase scene, and we've seen that on film. He said the one issue here that they had was all the safety rigs that they built for Tom Cruise, they all failed. So they ended up shooting the entire thing practically. He just went for it. The challenge was there, limited time he had in each location, and they only had the Arc de Triomphe for about 90 minutes to do this. And when you think about this scene, again, Tom, what's missing in your life? It had to be so precisely choreographed because he's driving against traffic, through traffic, through intersections.
Sometimes backwards.
Sometimes backwards. I mean, to edge this together and then have your, and we'll talk editing and the way that it was edited, and then the way that that motorcycle chase ends, like where it hits the car and then the camera switches and it rolls and it rolls. It hasn't stopped. Tom Cruise's face right in the camera, and you go, how the hell did they do that?
I was like, oh, poor Ilsa. Damn, girl. She can really take a hit.
Yeah, and it's just, again, it raises the adrenaline when you're in a great theater to see this. And you know, and again, bringing Rebecca Ferguson over.
Fucking love her.
Is a great idea as well because, you know, you had, who was the woman in... Oh, I can't think of her name. She was Patton.
Which movie?
Rogue Nation. Wait, who's in Rogue? Rebecca Ferguson was
Rebecca.
The third, the fourth Mission Impossible.
Oh, because
this is six. Patton. She was married to Alan Pitcher.
Paula Patton. Yes.
Right? You know, Michelle Monaghan has been in them, but Thandie Newton was in the second one. She's mm-hmm. not, you know. They've sort of kind of the team changes. And they've had our regulars, like Benji has become a regular. We missed out on Jeremy Renner, but there was more of Alec Baldwin. Yeah. I think because of that.
And of course we had Ving.
Ving, right? He was great in this movie.
As always.
So, and they need to do something with Jeremy Renner not being in this franchise.
But it's also good, sorry not to cut you off, to take another alpha male out because we had more alpha females in this one too. And this was probably also another reason why I like this movie so much is that it, for the first time in all the Mission movies, it felt like a balanced gender film. There were a lot of males, also a lot of strong females.
Yeah, I could see that. Let me ask you this. It's one of the things, especially early on in the movie, it felt like they were kind of making fun of Ethan Hunt. Just like he was running out of breath, his motorcycle wouldn't start at the start of the sequence, and all these things. And I thought, is he losing his edge? What the hell's happening here? And I thought that it would kind of play more of a role as far as him like overcoming those aspects.
No, I don't think it was more like, is he losing his edge? It just shows just how versatile Ethan Hunt is because he's able to adjust and adapt to situations so quickly. Like, his motorcycle's not working. He's like, all right, I'm going to catch up with you. When Elsa got, not to jump ahead, when she got kidnapped, whatever, and tied it, I felt like every action sequence had a moment where, like, okay, we have to improvise. Just go.
Yeah, and I think that, too, that it, it also countermands the cliche, the movie cliche where, you know, the hero gets on the bike. And, of course, it immediately starts. Hero's able to get a parking spot right in front of the museum.
Of course.
You know, this movie was like our hero's bike. He, like, the other guy goes off and he's like, damn it. And it ratchets up the tension because the pursuers are getting closer and closer and closer each time he's trying to ramp up their bike. I think it comes down to a conversation that they're having, and I think it's Macquarie's skill as building tension. And you go against cliche, and by doing that, you come up with something that makes it like, oh boy, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? You know, it's like jumping. It's like, you need to take a left now. Why'd you stop? Because I'm jumping out a window. Oh, I didn't see that. Oh, I didn't have it on 2D. You know, that scene, humor and great action, and we see Tom Cruise break his ankle, and yet he was still able to run towards the camera. You know, I mean, That's the level of realism that is unique to this franchise, and I think to all action movies, in all honesty. Again, when you talk about Skyscraper, which is an action movie, we know The Rock is in a ton of peril. I'm not saying he's not 60 feet up, which if he fell, that could hurt, but he's not hanging from a rock or a cliff.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I do want to also credit Tom and whoever you want, ultimately, but the fact that he's man enough to go up against a man, like Henry Cavill is a beast, and you know that plays a factor into it, because like you kind of look at him and he's towering over Tom, and the normal action hero, it's like, okay, this is your big badass dude, and mm-hmm. Oh, we support him, at least in the traditional sense, like you, and that is not the case deliberately with this.
Yeah.
And I think that's a, I appreciated that aspect of it.
Yeah, and for Henry Cavill too. I mean, so he's played the Man of Steel, right?
Ironically, replacing Tom Cruise in that film.
Yeah. Well, so yeah, and he like because he's Superman, he's big, he's larger than life because he's Superman. This movie here, I think, really showcased his brawn. Because you know, that fight scene in the bathroom, again, one of those brutal hand-to-hand things. And they were both getting beat to death. So when Henry Cavill is able to get back up, and you can see that he is bigger than Cruz. But when he does this, like, all right, I'm back in the ring, and he does that, you're like, oh, it's on. And you believe him because of his... He's a really brawny guy.
Yes. And he did that... he improvised that moment, and they're like, oh, damn.
Yeah.
The fist pump. Well, the thing is, Henry Cavill, he said in interviews that for Superman, it's more about the physicality. Like, his workout is to build the physical image and embodiment of Superman. And then Mission Impossible, he doesn't really have the training, the technical training of pulling off stunts.
Right.
He has the physical look of a character, not the technical aspect of a character.
Yeah.
So it was a challenge for him.
Yeah.
Well, he pulled it off.
Oh, he pulls it off.
Mustache and all.
I think, yeah.
American accent and all.
Yeah, I think he did a really amazing job here. And I don't think it was a risk for him, like, spoiler. I mean, him being the bad guy. Number one, I believe, because you could see that coming about a mile away. The moment he swaps out the phone, right? Mm-hmm. You know that he's this guy. If people are going to complain about that, my argument against that is, you know, that twist really isn't the important twist of the movie. I think you're meant to figure that out early on. There are other twists that happen that are brought up that are far larger and have bigger implications. Because he's the main obstacle that Cruz is going to have to get by at the end of the movie, and it's proven. So, again, the way that this screenplay was written, I found that, like, they give us this twist, but they give us this one nugget that we can figure out for ourselves, so that everything else seems and appears even bigger and more relevant to the story and moving it on.
So. Yeah, I mean, the whole crux of the movie works on this idea of dramatic irony. Like, we know what's... yeah. We know the mission, quote unquote, just like we'll get to it, but like the last action set piece, we know what needs to happen. How the hell is it gonna happen?
Right.
And that's the fun part of it all. Truly, I also want to talk about just take a quick moment, since we're kind of on the twists and turns, Alec Baldwin, his character, you know, all in all, if it wasn't Alec Baldwin, and I don't even necessarily think, like, it could have been Alec Baldwin, but it, had the part not been written in a certain way, had the film not progressed a certain way, when Alan Hunley dies, I don't think many people would have cared had it not taken the route that it did. The fact that he is – people find this as an emotional scene is incredibly well done as far as what the movie was able to pull off.
Right.
The fact that you can have that sort of emotion for – again, what, you know, no offense to Alec Baldwin or anyone else, like, is just a side character.
Yeah, and I think they did a good job with the establishment of Hunley. I mean, we've seen Alec Baldwin in the other movies, but this movie, like, quickly starts off his character in this film that, like, you're here, we're still together, you're the reason why, you know, you're still part of Mission Impossible and all that. So, like, they established that emotional, personal connection with each other. Like, we're in this together. I trust you. And then when we get the moment where he dies, it's like, oh, yeah. They are actually, they've gotten to such a personal, professional level with each other that it hurts when you see his character die because they got so close.
Yeah, and we can't forget, too, the way that that Alan Hunley character was brought up. He was supposed to be closing down the MI series. Okay, so he was looking for reasons to do it. And it was through Jeremy Renner's character, forgive me, that Hunley was able to see what happened. So at the end of that movie, Hunley's on board. He understands it. And so he even goes to the inquiry and says, we need them. We need the MI. We need
IMF.
Them, the IMF. We need them. And you could tell through the passage of time that Hunley has really become to appreciate Ethan Hunt. And in this movie, I think it's key in its dialogue that he says, no, the reason that you care about one person is why I have you on the team. Because someday I might be that person. And it's because of that the whole mission that I trust you in the mission because you will do what's right. Not necessarily do what need be. You're going to do what need be done, but you're going to make the right decisions and protect the right people. And that's important in this job. And Ethan Hunt has always done that since the first movie. So that you can tell their bond was done. And it was just, yeah, there was a little bit of an emotional love there when he died.
Absolutely.
It's too bad.
It's too bad, but it story-wise, like from a writer's perspective, it's just a fantastic moment and really well done all around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it kind of makes sense to wrap out the Hunley character, because what else could he, essentially, in just narrative storytelling, what else could Hunley add to the story?
Well, he's definitely the M from Bond movies. I mean, he's the head of the organization. I mean, and that's the thing. If I'm going to critique the movie at all, that's what they've done Erica Sloan, Angela Bassett. Because Erica Sloan is the early Hunley. She's the one, like, she doesn't believe in the IMF. She doesn't believe in Ethan Hunt and the team. She thinks it's because of them that they're in the mess that they're in because he didn't do his job right. And at the end of the movie, she turns around and now she's protecting the IMF. It's sort of
she's basically
a
like the new Hunley. And it makes sense that you would kill off Hunley just to create another relationship dynamic between Sloan now. Because now it seems like Sloan's going to take over.
Yeah, and it could have been Jeremy Renner, who can come back. I mean, the only reason he wasn't in this movie is because he was contracted to do Avengers. You know, and he wanted to. Well, I know, but he really, but that's the thing, too,
I think is
really cool about Jeremy Renner. Not only did he want to, he tweeted, like, in social media, he was in full support of everybody. I wish you guys the best. Wish I could have been with you. I mean, that to me, there was no sour grapes there on his end. You can tell that he really respects that cast and crew and being a part of it. So hopefully in the next one, he can be in a part of it. I'm glad he wasn't in this one, because from what I understand, he was going to die, that character. Had he been in it, and he would have died early. And I would have been like, no!
Well, so, he's still alive, so we can see him in the next film.
Yeah, but don't kill him.
That was the thing. Like, you know, yes, he was contracted to Marvel, but they were going to get him for 3 days. They could have gotten him. And
they would have killed him.
Yeah, and that's the whole thing. He's like, I don't want to come back just for 3 days just to be killed off. Like, I'll come back for 3 days, but don't kill me off.
I don't want
to
die.
So, who knows? Maybe in the 7th. I don't know.
But we also, not to sound terribly, he wasn't needed in this film.
No, not
like,
at all.
No gap.
We had enough characters. We had enough to deal with. Speaking of a new character, the White Widow. I thought she was an interesting character.
Great character.
A broker in between of all of this. I mean, the irony is, like, as much as we're touting this movie, like, if you really stop and think about it, none of it half makes sense. Like, here's a nuclear bomb as a payoff, you know what? And when you do this, we'll give you the two others. It's like, I already have one. I don't need another one. But, like, for objectively, like, if he was who he says he was and wasn't the person that killed women and children,
right,
a la William Money style.
Yeah.
That was just one of the more funnier lines. I'm like, Tom, why are you saying that? Anywho.
I think she was cool to watch. Her delivery and all of her lines were just like, yeah, awesome. Like, she was kind of very, you know, captivating in that way. But it also, like, not to say it was hard to believe her. It was just, you don't expect a person, like, with such dark ties and deep connections to so many different types of people in the fields that she was quote-unquote in, you know, involved in. You don't expect it from someone so young and also, not to sound terrible, a woman. Like a person of her stature. It was kind of cool to see, like, oh, this woman's tied to a lot of different ish.
A lot of different things. There was this temptation to the dark side. There was this playfulness that her mom, Max, shared with Ethan Hunt. And she actually got to accomplish something that Max didn't get to accomplish, which is she got to kiss Ethan Hunt, right, in that scene.
Not necessary. So not necessary. That, just saying.
Right. Didn't bother me in the least. I understood it.
Like, why?
Yeah, well, I completely got
mission
it.
Mission accomplished.
Yeah, no, I completely got it. And the other thing that was great about that character is that she's even though she was the
white widow.
The white widow, she's definitely a gray character. She's not necessarily evil, she's definitely not necessarily good. And you sort of got that sense that that's in the lineage when you compare her to Max as well. So she was in each scene that she was in, she commanded the scene. You know, her character made Ethan Hunt, even though Ethan Hunt was playing, he was supposed to be Lane, Jack,
John Lane.
John Lane.
Song
he was
Lane.
Uncomfortable.
John Lark.
So names. Ethan Hunt is John Lark. You could tell, like, it's stuff that she was saying. He was uncomfortable, but he had to go along with it. She was definitely, and she had the charisma to do it and to not be overshadowed by Tom Cruise. But Tom Cruise also didn't allow himself. Like, he didn't to play bigger in the scene.
Yeah, you get that from the first scene that they interact together. He's like, okay, I got to get you out of here, and you know he's dictating it overall, but she takes out her knife and stabs just the same. She's like, listen, great, we'll do this. I'll follow along. Like, it's great you want to save me, but I can save myself
too.
So, absolutely,
yeah,
she was a fantastic character.
She is.
I kind of want to start introducing Michelle Monaghan's character from this perspective, right? One of the things, there's so many ties to all the other movies, in particular the fifth one, obviously, that we've been talking about. But yet they do a really good job of, even if you've never seen any other Mission Impossible movie, they reset things for you and introduce things exactly when they need to. With this one in particular, it's like, okay, hey, Ethan Hunt, if he really cares about you, probably shouldn't be in his life because it kind of gets in the way of his job. Here's what happened to the last wife. And so, you know, that comes as a great moment. And, you know, anyone who's seen any other movie before will know, oh, she's probably going to come back.
Yeah.
Right. And I think it was so interesting, too, because it has been more than 10 years since the third one. I totally forgot Ethan was married, honestly. So when we saw Michelle Monaghan, I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. Shoot, what are you doing here, woman? Get out, because you might get hurt again.
Yeah, but she was also in the very end of, I think it was Rogue Nation, when they're all in San Francisco.
Not Rogue Nation, Ghost Protocol, I think.
Was it Ghost Protocol? They're all at the bar in San Francisco. And obviously, you come to find out that they were purposely there, because who do we see as a nurse walking into a bar with friends? It's Michelle Monaghan's character. with Ethan Hunt looking over her. So Ethan Hunt is, and her character, though, has been a part of, like, Ethan Hunt's protection of her through the movies. So she's been an important part, whether or not Michelle Monaghan has been in the movies, like, for an extended period of time, other than just a guest cameo. In this movie, she had more to do. And I really liked how she came, like, she had a part to play, and I enjoyed that. And there was a closure at the end of this movie of that relationship. And Ethan's always going to want to, Ethan's always going to love her and be protective. But he's happy that she's outside of this danger.
We'll backtrack, but the sort of wink from her now new husband, do you think it was a, like, hey, like, I get it. I know what you're really up to, and it's cool with me. Or he's just, like, really just that oblivious and giving him some sort of wink. You remember the
moment?
You remember the moment I'm talking about? Like, he finally, Ethan Hunt goes off, and he's like, I forget what he says, but it's just basically a, might as well be the stupid, like, keep up the great work, doctor.
Right.
And it's like, like, okay, like, I'm just saying that as, like, complete sarcasm, because I know it's complete BS, but I'm totally fine with it. Like, again, from the character perspective, that's what he's saying, not me as the audience member. And I laughed at it. I was like, ah, good for you guys.
I think that also just plays with the dramatic irony that the audience really knows what Ethan is.
Right.
And that, and Wes Bentley's character didn't.
I give him more credit than that. I don't think he's that dumb.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I mean, he comes off, well, number one, I was like, hey, I know him. I haven't seen Wes Bentley. Haven't seen him in a while. So it was good to see him in this kind of a role, and he was having fun with it. I think that he knew there was a history between. I don't think he knows exactly what Ethan Hunt did to save all of their lives, mm-hmm. but I think he knew that there was some history there. And that could have been the wink. But I loved how it wrapped up, because there was this great scene where we don't know what was said, when Rebecca Ferguson whispers in Michelle Monaghan's ear.
Yeah, what was that?
And, you know, they go off.
I need to know.
And I thought that was brilliant, because I don't know what was said, but it was something that necessitated it being whispered. And who knows, maybe it would be, I'll take care of him, I'll do that, whatever. And, like, there was an acceptance. And it was like Rebecca Ferguson's character, Elsa, saying, you know what, I really do care for Ethan. And I know that he's always going to care for you, but I'm, you know what, I'm going for this.
Absolutely.
So I need answers. I like that.
I need answers. We need another film so we can have Michelle Monaghan
just learn
back.
To lip read.
Well, the hair was covering
covered.
It too.
That was
it
actually
was covered.
Covered.
By hair. I mean,
and I'm just like, what does she say? What is she saying
yeah,
right now?
I
and
love
then
that
literally,
scene.
I did like that moment, because it felt like a passing of one woman to the next. Not a rebound. That sounds terrible. But, like,
it was
the passing
acceptance.
From, like, the first woman in Ethan's life to the next woman. And you can see a mutual respect for each other, and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and there was, like, oh, I understand. Like, I understand why he loved you. I get it. And I think it was a great scene.
It's the opposite of women being catty with each other and jealous and all the stereotypical bullshit that has just been portrayed hundreds of times and is just completely unnecessary.
And they still needed to keep the facade up as well. But I think it was just really good. It was just nice. And I don't know what was said, but it could have been, I'm going to take care of him as he watches you. I will watch over him for you. Or whatever it is.
Something like that.
I found it to be very nice.
I'm putting $100 that she said, do you want Kit Kat?
You want to have drinks after?
It was just interesting from the whispering to literally Elsa going up to Ethan. And then there was, like, that physical exchange and the look at each other like, what is happening? What is happening? I ship it. I totally ship it.
Yeah,
I do. I'm usually, and I've said it on past anatomies, that I'm not one for the whole older man, younger woman dynamic, like in the age gap, because Tom Cruise is 22 years older than Rebecca Ferguson. Well, just saying.
Just a number.
But I like the characters, both Ethan and Ilsa, so much, and they are equals to each other. They really are. And I was like, this relationship could work. I ship it so hard.
I feel like Tom Cruise's on-camera age is like 40. Although we don't need to go too far into it.
Dick Clark. He's aged extremely well. I don't have a problem with he and Rebecca Ferguson. As far as equals, like, they're each equally strong characters, to the extent that I would go, like, he can fly a helicopter? Like, even they don't know to the extent of what Ethan Hunt is able to do. And that's why, like, when Tom Cruise ever decides to bail on the series, right? I don't know who they fill it with. Because as much as I love Rebecca Ferguson, she's not going to do the stunts that Tom Cruise did. And I really do think that's an important aspect of these movies. But I like how they've set up this relationship, starting with the last movie, and showing that she is a strong woman, she can take care of herself, and that both of those characters... I loved when he says to her in this movie, like, walk away. Like, that's his way of not putting her down, but saying, I don't want you to come in harm because of me. Like, just walk away. Like, I care about you too much. I care about you.
You need to.
Yeah, don't. And that face-off scene in the car, and she's on the motorcycle, and he's like, don't. Damn it. He's like, yeah. And again, I think not enough. It's talked about fine acting in an action film, but the expressions on faces said so much more than words could.
Right.
And that scene, too, I thought was great. And it was played off fabulously by both actors.
But it also shows, like, why they are equals to each other. Because he will literally run her over. And she also said the line, like, don't make me go through you. Like, they will literally go over each other and go through each other. And, like, I like that. That's fun. Because, no, I dare you to name another woman in this franchise, Mission Impossible franchise, that would do that to Ethan Hunt. Who would actually challenge him in that way? No one besides Elsa.
The only thing that I can come up with is Thandie Newton, who actually injected herself with the Chimera virus to help get Ethan Hunt out of a situation, and believing in Ethan Hunt and potentially, like, getting the antivirus. It's the only thing that I can come up with. Paula Patton's character was a really strong character as well in her movie. But the chemistry between Ferguson and Cruise is undeniable. Really, so truly good. Is. It really
so
is.
So good.
It's very undeniable. And what I will challenge is, where in an action movie do you have this kind of chemistry? I mean, you know, this isn't Meet Mr. and Mrs. Smith or whatever that movie was with Brad Pitt.
Mr. and Mrs. Smith. Mr. Smith.
But the chemistry here really evolved the story. And it actually moves it along. It's not cliche, and it works.
Yeah.
Well, I want to talk about you mentioned the helicopter scene, so I want to talk about that. That's our sort of final action set piece, and a couple factors going into it. Number one, there was a very deliberate decision, like, okay, we're not just going to let Tom Cruise be the climax of the movie. We have to have other elements as well. So Benji and Ilsa, they get their own little section. Why? We've been calling her Michelle Monaghan. Julia is her character name. You have Julia and...
Luther.
I forgot his character name. We have Luther and her disarming the other piece. And then, of course, we have Ethan going up against the real John Lark now, as we learn. And so you have all these elements kind of playing together. Convoluted, maybe, but nonetheless, everyone has their part to play. And going into it... from my understanding, Tom spent a year and a half learning to helicopter pilot to pull this off. And as the third thing to set up this whole premise, there was only one country willing to accept this mission of letting Tom Cruise pilot a helicopter, which was New Zealand, that stands in for Casimir.
Yeah.
No other country would allow it.
And there's a...
I mean, good for them. Now they're in the credits.
Sure!
But also, just on top of Tom getting his actual helicopter pilot. I mean, we know he's a flyer. Like, we've known that for years. But to now be able to fly a helicopter slash act slash just fly, you know, just do whatever he can in a scene, it's like, you applaud him in that way, despite his personal crap that a lot of people don't like. But him as an actor, as an artist, what the hell? I mean, who else does that? No one. Really? No one. Good for him.
Well, I say good for him, but again, it just goes back. What is missing in your life, sir, that you need to fulfill this, like,
he wants
this,
to entertain audiences.
Well, I get
literally,
it.
He's going to die during a movie.
He could. And here's a funny thing, and perhaps you already know about it. I'll say it for the audience, because maybe you haven't heard about this. So the scene where he's literally hanging from a helicopter, okay, and he's on the net, we'll call it. Mm-hmm. Well, Rebecca Ferguson and Simon Pegg were watching. They weren't in the scene, but they're watching.
They were drinking coffee.
And they were filming.
They literally said they were I was drinking a double espresso.
Yeah, and they know how nutty Tom Cruise is in doing his stunts, his own stunts, and he's climbing up. But they didn't really know about the scene, and so when he fell, their initial thought was, "Oh, it's over. We're done." He's dead. Oh, my God. Like, he's just like, they fell. They didn't see the harness. They actually were like, our careers are over. He's dead. They're like going, oh, my God, Tom, it finally caught up with you. And, like, it's shocking because I would have been the same way.
Well, it looked like happen. He died.
No kidding. It looks like he
who falls and hits and still alive? No one.
And not only that, he's holding on.
Well, one of my favorites is, like, he was very conscious. He's like, I got to make sure I face the camera. Like, he's, out of all things he's worried about, got to make sure I face the camera.
Well, well, that's in a plane sequence, but falling and then grabbing the net and they don't see him.
No, but you also notice that he's turning to the camera deliberately.
And the halo jump, same deal too. I have to come here and I got to look around, but I got to be conscious of my cameraman. It is quite, he's cognizant about that. So when you're talking that helicopter scene, number one, I actually do think that flying through those caverns, like, you know, the river there, I think the look of peril on his face is real.
Yeah.
I really think it was like going, oh, shit.
He's like, yeah, I knew it.
You know? but look, God bless him. I hope he never dies making a movie.
He's going to.
And
I think that's, like, I'm pretty sure that's how he wants to go up.
But yeah, it's just, I know that he and Grizz McQuarrie talk about this. They talk about it a lot, and they do take the time to ensure that this is going to work. But it's a stunt, breaking an ankle. You know, anything can go wrong. But again, I think it works with when you're talking about Tom Cruise and the realism and him interjecting ideas. We talked about this in The Mummy. I don't think he's ever going to work with, I think it was Kurtzman, whoever directed The Mummy. I don't think we'll see him work with him again. We'll see him. We definitely know he's going to work with Doug Liman again. They did Live, Die, Repeat. Edge of Tomorrow. Made in America, which is a really good movie. He does his flying. We talked about that here. He even did his crash landing, right? These people are his muses. He's working with this Joseph Kaczynski again, who we worked with on Oblivion, and he's making Top Gun Maverick. There's something about, he's come away in his career, and he's worked with so many directors in his lifetime. Right, in his career so far. But these people, they entertain his ideas. They help bring these ideas. I don't think that Tom Cruise is, like, forceful. I think in The Mummy, remember we talked about Tom Cruise was getting in the way of things? I don't think
he was. It just was perceived that way.
Yeah, well, I just think that when he's working with McQuarrie, Liman, or Kaczynski, I think they're, again, I use that word, simpatico. They communicate in a way where they want to where they agree upon the vision, and how, like, Chris McQuarrie never says no, because I want to make the best movie and show you something that you've never seen. His challenge was in this movie, how do I make it look different? Because that's one of the reasons why they've always brought in different directors to give it a different visual sense. And so they made this movie look different than the last movie, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, in particular, in that helicopter scene,
yeah.
In every other movie, the dropping of the cargo net onto the plane would have been the aha moment, and everything would have been, because it's just such a simple thing of like, oh my god, he pulled it off, he timed it so well, and the fact that this just falls in the water, it's like, crap, I gotta think of something else,
right?
Mm-hmm.
And then he's like, I just gotta crash into them.
Yep.
What else have I got?
Yeah.
So, you know, that, and it's, and when we talk about elongating the action sequences, that's a way to do it in a way that forces the hand of our protagonist to be like, I gotta really one up this.
Right, and I liked the, you could call it a running joke, or like, how are you gonna get the remote? I'll think of something.
Right.
Like, I'm getting it to it.
And that
I'm
was,
making a plan.
That, and that was like, well, what do you plan to do? I don't know yet.
I'm working on it.
wait, you hope that she's never met this Lang character before? Yeah, it's all I got. You know, he goes with his gut. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And you're right, Phil. That would have been like the pinnacle moment in another helicopter movie. Dropping the net on them, it's like, yay! But no, the scene goes on.
It'd be too easy.
It would have been too easy. It might have looked great. But having the helicopters hanging off a cliff, I mean, rolling down a mountain. It just ratchet.
I just kept thinking, I was like, what kind of roller coaster ride would this be at, you know, like an actual amusement park? I was like, this could be an actual ride and people would enjoy it.
I just felt amazing.
And on top of that, Tom Cruise also had to scale the mountain afterwards to get the remote.
Yeah.
Like, because that I love that scene where he's now on the mountain, on the side of the mountain, gearless.
Rock climbing again.
Literally free climbing. And the camera pulls away because the cinematographer is in a helicopter. You're like, oh crap, he's really free climbing.
Yeah.
That's Tom Cruise.
And it just, that harkens back to the opening of Mission Impossible 2,
mm-hmm.
when he's rock climbing again. And I can do it. God bless him. God bless him.
Absolutely. Any other... we're getting to the time where we got to start talking about promotion and so forth, and there's a lot to talk about there, but anything production-wise that you want to cram in real fast?
Well, yeah, actually, because I found this very fascinating, and catch this. So the first pass of the movie was just over, catch this, 3 hours. And then they screened a cut for an audience just 11 days after they put it together, and that ran 2 hours and 43 minutes without credit. And the first test was 2:39 without credits, and we pared that back 20 minutes. 3 scenes never saw the light of day. I knew the franchise well enough by then to know their chances of survival. I didn't even edit these scenes until I had settled in the final cut, and only then as an exercise. So, listen, if they decide to bring McQuarrie back, which they should. I think McQuarrie has hinted that he'd be game for it. They just should, because they work together well. And if they even want to make another Reacher movie, their biggest mistake, I think, was not going to McQuarrie. Bring McQuarrie back. The second Reacher movie was watchable, but it definitely wasn't as good as the first. And McQuarrie knows his stuff.
Eventually, I would love to see James Cameron and and Tom Cruise once they're both done with a couple of movies.
You know, that's not a bad idea either. I think that
underwater
could. Oh,
Rogue Nation had that underwater tank sequence, but like with James Cameron, that'd be ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. I mean,
underwater.
I agree, and I think you've got 2 very dedicated people, let's say, that I think that it could, again, they would be like, oh yeah, well, what if we did this? And the other guy would go, great idea. And what if we added this?
it would be such a
display of one-upsmanship.
Yeah.
It'd be great.
Fight sequence underwater. Saying, throwing that
fight
out there.
Fight sequence
underwater.
With not a Halo jump, but you're actually going to be in space falling.
They teased it. Why not?
So the one aspect we haven't talked about is the music as far as production is concerned. You know, what's great is we always get the theme, but we actually get quite a number of variances that I appreciated in this. I thought, you know, the soundtrack, not only we've been saying this for a couple weeks now, it served the movie. This didn't just serve the movie, but it elevated the movie. So I appreciated that.
It did. I'm going to go as far. So the past couple of times, who's the soundtrack golden boy? Michael Giacchino had done a few, and his soundtracks to the Mission Impossible series are really good. Lorne Balfe, my first watching the movie, I was like, a lot of this sounds okay. It sounds really good. I'm like, there's a little Hans Zimmerish, and then when I actually got the soundtrack, listened to it. So yes. There's Hans Zimmer Dark Knight influences there, and believe it or not.
Especially the dream sequence.
Yeah.
Because that was all music. But also, Lorne Balfe was Hans Zimmer's personal assistant for 10 years.
Yeah, which makes sense why it would sound like that. But I also heard, believe it or not, there was some Tron Legacy in there. I don't know where that came from, but there literally was some Tron Legacy soundtrack. You're right. There were different variations, interpretations. It wasn't just the Mission Impossible scene. And I agree with you as far as the movie go. It elevated. It did what it should. It never overpowered the movie, but it did ratchet up. It helped ratchet up the tension and the excitement and the adrenaline. It was decent. It is a decent soundtrack that works on its own. So, yes. If for those people who like soundtracks, I would suggest you download it, upload it, stream it, listen to it. It's a good soundtrack.
Well, speaking of songs, too, I really love the use of Imagine Dragons' song in the trailers.
Yeah,
that just had a great kickoff pace to everything.
Don't write the fiction.
I thought, you know, this. So, oftentimes we kind of guess on the marketing budget. This one. Has been kind of released now. How fully accurate it is, I don't know, but $140 million just on advertisement. That is a budget and a half for most movies.
Yeah.
Yeah. And for the promotion, the cast, so it was Tom Cruise, Henry Cavill, and Rebecca Ferguson, and Simon Pegg. They all went on the Graham Norton show back in January. The beginning of the year. I remember I watched it when it first came out, so it was great. It was the first time that the cast who was still filming at the time went on the Graham Norton show, so they got it during production. And they mentioned before that they were going to release the full trailer on the day of Super Bowl.
Yeah.
They had the teaser during the Super Bowl, but the full trailer would be released the same day on YouTube.
Yeah. Yeah, I think from a marketing standpoint, and again, I know at CinemaCon I mentioned McQuarrie and Cruise. After they did their Film School 101, they did bring out Simon Pegg and Rebecca Ferguson, and I believe Angela Bassett showed up. I know later on that evening, Tom Cruise was fitted with an award. But yeah, they've been together. They know each other. I think that's the other thing, too, with Tom Cruise. I think that he's come to a point in his career, and this could have been from a decade or so ago, where actors that he feels very comfortable with and working together with, you know, like they just announced this Glenn Powell being, he missed the opportunity to play Goose's son in Maverick, the new Top Gun sequel, but he liked him enough that they got another role for him to bring him in. And I think working with Simon Pegg, working with Rebecca Ferguson, too, I believe that...
He likes his team.
He just likes to work with some people, and he understands that these people get him. He understands them. They're professional. I wouldn't be surprised if we see Cavill work together with him again, because I really think that Cavill brought his A-game in this movie.
100%.
I really liked him a lot. And I wouldn't be surprised if they paired up in another movie. So, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
I would watch for that, and I would go.
Yeah, totally.
Well, here's a fun segue, too. Speaking of watching, a lot of people are watching this movie because it's pulling in some numbers.
Yes.
Yeah.
I have August 1st numbers, but if anyone has more updated numbers, by all means, jump in. Otherwise, I'll just continue talking.
Yeah, no, I have the domestic total as of August 2nd. Currently, it's at $89.4 million. Let's just call it. It's about 90 thus far. Worldwide gross is 205. I mean, it's worldwide. Tom Cruise is a star. He's a movie star. He is, like, there aren't many like him today anymore. He's international. People love him. And the thing about Cruise is, if you've been noticing, since we're talking marketing a bit and his traveling, he number one, he does have an entourage ever since that silliness that happened where somebody squirted him with a squirt gun. It's that idiot. Mm. But he still will take time. I just saw a press. He tweeted out a photo. I think it was the last premiere that they're doing, so he can get to go on vacation. But he took pictures with the crowd, and he was smiling. And he is a showman, and he will promote your movie. And he'll go all out to do it. Like, he doesn't just stop. Some people don't like to do this. He rallies behind his movies, and I think that's a plus. And I think that's what makes him an international box office star.
Right, and this movie was also released internationally first.
Yeah.
Like, U.S. wasn't the first country to get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we were so mission last.
It makes sense that the foreign numbers would actually be bigger than U.S. because they got it first. They had it 2 weeks earlier.
I'm guessing, like, you know, we do a percentage breakdown. I wouldn't be surprised if it was like 75% international, like when it's all said and done.
Yeah, but thus far it's about 56.5% in international gross, 43.5% domestic. You know, it's the highest gross Mission Impossible, opening weekend gross Mission Impossible movie. And again, I do think that that's towards the marketing. They found the niche in which to do it, but then they deliver the goods. It's not just one scene, because they will focus on, say, the Halo scene. And I think it's brilliant, because the Halo scene comes in 20 minutes. I said this at the top. There's a rest of the movie to go through. And those scenes rival, it's not better than the Halo jump scene. Like, you think you see the best, and it comes at the beginning of the movie. And I think audiences are attuned to that. And when it delivers and delivers strongly, you can hear the people talking about it exiting the movie theater.
Yeah.
It's great stuff.
Mm-hmm. It's mainly because they're playing our show on their phones.
Yeah.
So they hear us.
Yep.
Well, I mean, A on cinema score, 97% on Rotten Tomatoes, 92% audience score. So across the board, you are correct. Everyone is talking about it in quite a positive manner. I was hard-pressed to find any sort of negative review. The only one that I found was The Guardian said, there isn't as much humor in the dialogue as before.
And I disagree.
I'm also like, do you really? Like, I don't go to see Mission Impossible for the humor. This is not a Marvel movie. I'm good without the humor.
And it's also the highest, if you're going by Rotten Tomatoes, it's the best reviewed Mission Impossible movie of the entire franchise.
Yeah.
Good for it, because it deservedly
and it's the
is high.
But it's the sixth movie in this series. The sixth. You know how, like, difficult that is to accomplish? Where, like, just to keep making good movies. Like, just to keep movies that might get in the 85 percentile on Rotten Tomatoes could be it's extremely difficult.
If this is a knock on Tremors, I will not hear it.
No,
that franchise
no.
is fantastic, no. And the sixth one is right up there.
It's not a knock on Tremors. I'm just saying, like, this is the sixth movie within this series, and at its sixth, it's getting its best reviews ever. And when you look back at the other movies, they didn't get rotten.
No.
Ever.
Yeah, you can't say that for Fast and Furious.
No.
Yeah. And critics. I think that's the good thing with Mission Impossible. You think with the era sequelitis that we have, that people might get tired of this. And this franchise has been out for 22 years as of this film.
Yeah.
You think people might get tired of it? No. The fact that it's gotten even higher ratings, more money, they're doing something right.
And it survived dare I say it, it survived Tom Cruise, okay? So after the second one, in between the one that J.J. Abrams directed, there is the period that some people will call Tom Cruise unhinged, where he was jumping on Oprah's couches. I could care less if he was jumping on a couch saying how much he loved Katie Holmes, but whatever. I don't care because what he does in his relationship, fine. What are you giving me for movies? So I know that there was even trepidation, and part of the reason going into Mission Impossible 3 was to try to resurrect this career because it was in a tailspin because of all the mishigosh that was going on with his life, his personal life. But regardless, who cares? He bounced back quite well, because between that, he not only had Mission Impossible, I think Tropic Thunder may have fallen in there. He did Collateral. The guy's done a
Valkyrie.
Lot of...
There was also Night and Day.
He did Night and Day. And then he kept on coming back to the Mission movies. The Mission movies, in a sense, were the movies that were revitalizing his career. But even when you watch movies like Made in America, he's never afraid to take a role that might not paint Tom Cruise in a bad light. He'll take a villainous role, saying Collateral. He's been able to accomplish with what other actors, like, say, Harrison Ford. When Harrison Ford was in What Lies Beneath and he was the villain, that tanked his career. People did not want to see Harrison Ford like that. Tom Cruise, he's been able to accomplish that and get away with it. But he's a really solid actor, and I think his career is... He's going to continue to be a star.
Absolutely. Well, we've talked a lot about the movie. I'm sure there's plenty of other stuff that we could talk about, but that's what the comment section is for. We get to expand upon the conversation. Hopefully, we've given you enough to at least digest for now. Thank you guys, as always, for tuning in with us and all that. The mission is about to be over. The final things that we have to do is let you know where you guys can send us further missions. At Serafini TV for Marissa.
That's right.
At DMovies1701 for Dimitri.
Please.
I'm at Phil Svitek, and of course, this is at The Popcorn Talk. We are on Twitter and Instagram. We're at Movie Anatomy, but of course, the full name of the show is Anatomy of Movie. Next week, we will be doing Christopher Robin. Mm-hmm. So, looking forward to that. The Meg in a couple weeks and so forth. Lots of great movies still to come. In the meantime, thank you as always. We'll see you next time.
Bye, all.
For producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.